You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the RSA. I'm Severa Davis. I'm Associate Director of Design here, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you all today to today's special lunchtime talk. It is my great pleasure to introduce our afternoon speaker today, David Butler. David Butler is Vice President of Innovation and Entrepreneurship at the Coca-Cola Company, and under his leadership, Coca-Cola has been awarded numerous design awards, and in 2009 he was recognized by Fast Company as a Master of Design, which is a very cool title. David is also a member of the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda on Design and Innovation. He first joined Coca-Cola to revolutionize the company's approach to design, focusing not just on how things look, but creating holistic, purposeful, and that's an important word, system-based approach to creating value across the organization. What he learned from this process, the successes and the failures, the case studies and the practical takeaways are the subject of his new book, Design to Grow. David's approach is particularly relevant to the RSA and specifically the program of work that I run, which is the RSA Student Design Awards, a quick plug here. The RSA Student Design Awards is a global curriculum and competition that asks design students to apply their skills in new ways, to think of designers as holistic, strategic connection makers and looking at how we can use design skills to solve real problems in the world. So it really is a great pleasure to have you here at the RSA today, David. Without further ado, please welcome David Butler.
Okay, so we're going to talk about growth, and you knew this before you came in, that we all want growth, right? We want growth personally. I want growth for myself, for my family. I've got three daughters. I want growth for my community, for my city, for my country. We all want growth, but of course, you know, companies want growth as well. And the thing is, growth looks different depending on what stage of a company that you're in. These are two co-founders starting a startup. For them, growth looks like scale. They look at growth in terms of scale, how they can scale their product, their team, how they can scale geographically, and so forth. Large companies, public companies especially, look at growth in terms of agility. How can they react to market changes? How can they adapt to a quickly changing marketplace around them and stay flexible, right? So what may be interesting or maybe something you haven't thought about is the way that you design for scale is actually quite different than the way you design for agility. And, of course, that's why we wrote the book. But that's what the talk is going to be about. So let's first look at designing for scale. The whole point or purpose of designing for scale is to get to scale, is to reduce the friction around whatever you're trying to do, create, sell, and scale it, right? Scale it geographically in most cases. So a convenient example for me personally is the Coca-Cola Contour bottle, which is what we call the glass bottle. And this is typical amongst everyone, every company. There's a time of exploration, right? And same thing with Coke. So these are different forms of the package that occurred over several years. But again, with the idea of one day scaling around the world. But here's where design comes in. So in this case, design is used to reduce things. In this case, simplify, standardize, and integrate various components of that package so that it could be scaled to what's today over 200 countries around the world. And I love this photograph because it really proves the point. This is 1929 in Beijing, China, actually the first time the company went into China. And you can see how the company did this. So again, one package, the Contour bottle, was standardized in 1915. We're celebrating our 100-year anniversary, in fact, this year. So that package, this familiar script logo, we call the Spencerian script. You can't see it because it's black, but this is Coca-Cola red. It's a specific color red that we call Coca-Cola red. And also the price. They used one price for almost 70 years, the equivalent of a nickel, 5 cents U.S., was used. And this is how they simplified and standardized and integrated those components together to scale. And that's exactly how you use design to scale. And then just some quick numbers, just to give you a sense of how it worked. Today, the company, in fact, has $20 billion brands. I do a lot of work with startups, and all of them want to be a unicorn, a billion-dollar brand. It's quite fashionable these days. But the company, in fact, has $20 billion brands inside of its portfolio, Coke just being one of those. Again, local in 200 countries, 500 brands in the portfolio, over 700,000 employees worldwide, 24 million customers. So anywhere you buy a Coca-Cola or another one of our products is a customer of the Coca-Cola company. And then 1.9, almost 2 billion servings a day. So 2 billion times a day, someone partakes of one of our products. So, you know, what happens when you reach that kind of scale, whether you're Coca-Cola or any other large company, and there's a massive disruption in your world? So whether that's a startup or a new technology or a big macro trend like aging baby boomers, these things are very disruptive, and this has, you know, elicited a whole host of certainly books around disruptive innovation and these types of titles. But what do you, in fact, what do, right? You don't need to design for scale. In this case, you have scale. In our case, we have scale. We need agility, and this is where we'll go in to talk more about designing for agility. There's a in the book, we use this example around Legos, and I've asked this question around the world. I can't help but ask it here again. How many people are familiar with Legos? You know Legos. Yeah, so I have three daughters. If you have children, you probably step on them, as I do every day. If you don't, you remember playing with them. But the great thing about Legos is they have, it's a system. And in fact, they have two sets of elements. One set of elements we call fixed elements. And those are the familiar set of core bricks that they have in every set. That's the first fixed element. And the second is how they connect. So that familiar locking mechanism that they connect. These two things haven't changed for 50 years. In other words, Legos have been around for 50 years. These haven't changed, and the way that they lock together haven't changed. Those are fixed. What has changed is, and how they stay adaptable, are these components. So in this case, if you're into Harry Potter, how many people are into Harry Potter? Yeah, everyone. So Harry Potter, if you're a Harry Potter fan, you can buy an additional set of bricks to add to your core set of bricks to create Hogwarts Castle, right? And they have many different sets of bricks like this, and this is how they keep up with changing tastes and trends over time. And this is, again, just to illustrate the fact that they have both fixed and flexible elements. Again, this is how they stay adaptable over time. That's Legos. That's a toy company. Now let's connect it to how we do what we do at Coca-Cola. One challenge that we have is this one. So how can we be smarter in a constantly changing marketplace? How many people are aware that we are actually the largest juice company in the world? Ah, a couple. Most people don't know that. So anyway, in fact, we are. So we're the largest juice company in the world. But as you can imagine, juice is not a formula. In fact, it's a recipe. No one knows exactly what kind of fruits, in this case oranges, but what kind of fruits are going to come out of the ground or be produced. It's a natural product, right? So we don't know exactly how the supply is going to be created year to year. We also don't know exactly what the tastes are going to be from country to country. Again, we're in over 200 countries. Some people like their juice, different combinations of juice that others don't. Some like their juice thick, some like their juice thin, some like bits in their juice, some people don't. So juice is actually quite dynamic as a product category for us. So how do you use this fixed and flexible elements, this designing for agility approach, in our case, to juice? Well, when it comes to packaging, we use it this way. So we have these elements, just like the Legos. We have these branding elements that we use consistently across every country, every form of packaging in the portfolio. And the pieces that are flexible are actually the brands that we have. So we actually have many brands of juice that we use around the world competitively and to, again, expand our portfolio. And, of course, we have many different types of fruits and vegetables that we can, use depending on the supply. And so just to the right, you can see that we actually can adapt to almost any size package, any kind of ingredient, and that gives us incredible agility as we move from market to market. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. Another question. How can we operate faster in new developing markets? So for us and other companies, developing markets are a huge opportunity for our company. So in this case, I was recently in Vietnam, so I just use these two photos. But so Ho Chi Minh City, sometimes the biggest challenge we have is actually getting our product to the shelf, the physical distribution of our product to the shelf. And so imagine trying to drive a big red Coca-Cola truck through that crowd in rush hour. Ain't going to happen, So what do you do? And if you go just a few miles outside the city, imagine trying to get a big red truck down that, you know, to cross that bridge. Not going to happen. So we use this approach. And in fact, the fixed elements in this case are our products. We have the same products. We use a crate, the same crate, to deliver to our customers. Again, our core set of customers. Those are fixed. That's what we have to do. We have to get that product in that crate to that guy, right? But how we get it there is quite flexible. We use bicycles. You know, you can see donkeys, carts, motorcycles, mopeds, yes, and big red trucks to get it there. And this has actually allowed us to be quite flexible and gain market share quite successfully around the world. And it's difficult to read up there, but just look at the big red piece. That's the part that we're interested in. So anyway, so that's how we can actually move into, again, developing economies and move quite quickly and capture market share. Does that make sense? Yeah, so same approach. We're not talking about packaging. We're talking about distribution. Yeah. Last example. How can we be leaner with innovation? And, you know, I work with one of the largest companies in the world, and I can tell you every large company is asking themselves this question. Because, again, like every other company, we know our industry. We know the beverage industry. We created many of the categories inside of that industry. So we know that industry quite well. But when you look at, you know, fast-growing startups who are, you know, developing or leveraging new technologies in new spaces, new business models, you know, often we look at that, like every other company, and think, you know, how do they do that? How can a company go from, there's a startup out there called Slack. They launched 7 months ago. Now they're already valued at $1 billion. They're a $1 billion company in 7 months. How does that happen? How do you do that? So we asked ourselves that question and, in fact, used the same approach to that. So in this case, the fixed elements are we decided to work to partner with proven founders who had been through, had created companies before, had a big exit, successful exit, sold their company, or more likely had a big failure or two or three. But, you know, proven founders, experienced founders. We also focus on what we call shark bite problems. Shark bite problems. And that has to do with the pain. We feel that if a founder can actually find a solution to a shark bite problem that a lot of people have, they can create a big business around that. And what I mean by shark bite problem is if a mosquito bites me, I have some level of pain around that. If a shark takes a big portion of my body away from me, that's a whole other level of pain. So we focus on shark bite problems, and that's a fixed element. We also connect these founders with people inside of our business, senior level people inside of our business who act as advisors to help them navigate inside of a large company that we have. And we also use metrics and milestones, like every other company that does this, to measure progress and growth. Those are fixed. Those never change. What's flexible are our assets. The first one up there is just brand Coca-Cola. But we have assets inside the company, and in fact, every large company has this. We have assets. We have relationships with almost anyone. In other words, we could pick up the phone and call the CEO of Walmart just as easily as Bono, right? When we have these types of relationships, global relationships in every industry across every country. And then we're technology agnostic. So we don't care what technology they use to grow a business. It's totally up to the founders. How they grow their team is completely up to them. They're their own independent startup. They're not employees of the Coca-Cola company. And then just the financial vehicle we use is a convertible note, so that once they reach sustainability, we can convert our investment into equity. And those are the flexible elements. And to date, we've been doing this actually for the last about 18 months. And we've launched, well, this year we have in the current portfolio of about 11 startups, including Twistilled, which is in blue. They launched last night here in London. I was actually at the launch party last night. And so you'll hopefully see more about Twistilled soon. But in fact, we're in 11 different cities around the world, and we've created this global network of entrepreneurs to get after this opportunity. Does it make sense? Yeah, so same approach, same design approach, using the same, let's say, Lego-like approach, but creating completely new businesses. Yeah. So that's the short story, and it sounds like a commercial. Believe me, I don't do this every day. Wrote a book about it, and it just launched today here in the UK. And again, happy to get into questions. Yeah? Thank you.
Great. Thank you, David. So I guess I'm curious from, first of all, your own journey from you trained as a designer, and now you're in charge of innovation and entrepreneurship. So you could tell us a little bit about that journey. I read online that at some point you wanted to be a dentist. So what happened there?
Yeah, you know, I said that to one reporter one time, and that has followed me forever, which is, I'm not ashamed of that, but that is true. I answer that in two ways. I have a belief that everyone is a designer, and I actually don't think that you have to have the word design in your title to be a designer. In fact, all of us designed our route to get here today. You design what you have on your body, and you put together what you're wearing. Someone designed this PowerPoint presentation. Someone designed this chair, the lighting. You know, everything is designed by somebody. And so I actually feel like the first thing, I think that we're all designers to some capacity. Some of us are just better at designing some things and better than others, right? So we can all be better designers. And that was one theme we had in the book. For me personally, I worked as a designer, and how many people remember the dot-com era? You know, around the 2000, yeah? So I'm dating myself, but around that time, I really wanted to move out of design and, in fact, design businesses. I started a dot-com, consulted dot-coms, and I moved into, at that time, they called me a brand strategist. And to your point, I wanted to be involved in strategy, actually designing from the very beginning the solution to a problem. And I didn't want to be, which is often the case, tacked on to the back end to make something look prettier or more readable or something like that. So, in fact, I didn't want to be a designer anymore, what was called a designer. I wanted to be more of a strategist. And that has been the way I've thought from the very beginning. So, actually, I don't call myself a master of anything. I don't call myself an innovator or a designer. But that's just how I think. Yeah. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, I think, I imagine there's probably people who are interested just to hear specifically about your journey from being a designer into Coca-Cola, first as global head of design, and then on to in charge of innovation and entrepreneurship. So charting that journey, I think, would be quite useful.
Sure. So, yes, I just a very quick story is I was working in a company, a design firm, a graphic design firm, working on the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, Georgia. And I loved that job because at that particular time, the firm I was working for worked on large-scale systems. And in that case, the Olympics, you focus on everything from designing pencils to stadiums. And I love that diversity, that sense of scale. So that's where I really sort of formed a love of both systems and large-scale projects. Moved from there into, actually started a dot-com right out of there. Started a company which failed very quickly, I'll say. And but I learned a lot from that. So designing a company from end to end was something I really enjoyed. Went from there to consulting, business consulting as a brand strategist. I moved to New York and was involved in the whole sort of dot-com scene at that time, which was quite fascinating. And then, as you'll recall, if you remember that time at all, the dot-com became a dot-bomb, you know. And rebounded out of that and started working with, consulting with UPS and designing UPS.com. And again, this is before there was a UPS.com. So I was able to look at logistics, interactive applications, all these things that had to come together to form a UPS.com, which is now one of the major sources of their revenue. So it was led the team of development around that. That's when I got the call from Coke to come in and focus on design. And that was actually the brief. Help us create more value out of design. And my first question was, what do you mean by design? You know, because design can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. And that was actually part of the problem. They didn't have a clear vision, a strategy around design, and that was the job. So did that for the last 7 or 8 years or so. Successful with that, and was asked to, about 2 years ago, was asked to focus on innovation. And familiar question, what do you mean by innovation? Because innovation can mean a lot of things to a lot of people, and what that turned into was a focus on the whole startup world, startup community, the lean startup movement, and a desire for our company to be engaged in that in some way.
Excellent. So I want to pick up on that point about letting everyone be a designer and the fact that everyone already is a designer. And so kind of a question around education, which has to do with, do you think in your role that we should be training more people in design, but specifically some of the things you're talking about here, how to scale things up, how to identify fixed and flexible elements? Do you think that's something that should be part of a broader, almost a liberal arts education?
I do, and I'm sure you knew I was going to say that. I have to say my focus is on helping companies design better. I've chosen that as my career path, so I love that. So in my context, I'd say all business managers can actually be much better designers we all can be better designers, but in this context, learning how to use design to scale, if you're in a early stage company, or if you're in a large scale company, learning how to use design to be more agile is available for anyone. Again, I don't feel like you have to have the word design in your title to take advantage of that, but again, I mentioned I have three young daughters, and of course, I think about this and they're for them as well. So for me, design is all about holistic or systems thinking, connecting that to design and understanding all the interrelated issues that are involved in a solution or problem. Wicked problem is another way to think about that. But from that perspective, yes, I do feel like everyone has the opportunity to be a better designer.
I'm probably preempting some of the questions from the audience here, but one of the things that you've talked about, the scale and the agility and being able to pivot, is something that I think lots of people will be thinking about, but most people will be thinking, how do you... it's all well and good if you know you want to do that, but how do you create buy-in in an existing organization to be allowed to do that? And I know there's lots of anecdotes in the book. You gave one around launching a new brand in China, the Ku brand. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about sort of some advice for people who are thinking, well, how do I do this when you don't have an organization that already sees the value in it?
Yeah, I suggest that most senior-level positions or people that reach senior-level positions inside of companies didn't reach them by failing quite a bit, right? Normally, failure isn't associated with rising to the top. But in this case, I think just to take a lesson from the startup community, there's a phrase out there called failing fast. How many people have heard of that before? Failing fast, everyone. And so, as you know, what that actually means is learning fast. So founders inside of startups are often working in uncharted waters, using different technologies that launching new products or services that don't exist. So for them, failing fast is just a form of learning. And I think once you make that mind shift that you don't look at it as failing, you look at it as learning as fast as possible so you use the least amount of time and money to get there. So that's a big learning, I think, that should happen, could happen inside of most large corporations. So that's one thing. There's only two. Second, to your point, is I think you have to be very open and transparent with the process. So I think oftentimes inside of large companies, there are small, innovation, skunk works teams that go off in a corner somewhere, and you don't know exactly what's happening over there, but they're doing something innovative. I think that's a huge problem. And if you are engaged with the startup community at all here in London, we have a huge scene here, that sharing is part of how they work. So sharing developers or contacts, just being very open and transparent is something that we can all learn from the startup community. And I think that goes hand in hand with viewing failure as learning.
Great. I think we'll open it up to questions now.
Hello, my name's Jeremy Kaplan. I'm a fellow here, and I've had roles in multinationals in global, regional, and local level. And I wanted to pick up particularly on organisational design. You talked about everybody having design inside them. As an observer, and it's maybe a little bit provocative, but if you looked at Coca-Cola over the years, they seem to just cyclically gone between one day it's all being decided centrally and the next minute it's really important that it's local or regional, and you seem to have cycled backwards and forwards between the two. Do you just stumble from model to model until one wears out, or do you actually have a very clear blueprint that allows everybody to have ideas and design and contribute and for those ideas to flow through?
Yeah, I personally believe that those cycles are just that. They're always, there's a cycle in motion. And you can choose any large organization, any global organization, I'd suggest that it's very similar. But I can assure you that this approach is what we use. So every campaign, the way that we manage our supply chain is using this approach. So there are fixed components and flexible components, and that's how we can design things, let's say, in Atlanta that can adapt quite easily here in London. So, and vice versa, something can be designed in London and adapt quite easily in the U.S. in that scenario. So there are two different things I suggest. One is cyclical, and the other is an approach to making things.
Yeah. Thank you. It's Brian Kilkenny, World Cities Network. I'm interested in the issue of cities and the rapid growth of cities. And I was wondering how much of a sort of a shark bite problem is the distribution issue, is the kind of congestion, is the growing cities for Coca-Cola, or is it just one of those little mosquito ones you described. And kind of within that, what can cities learn from this approach? I mean, cities are all challenged to grow and to solve infrastructure issues. It seems to me that some of this thinking could be very useful for city leaders as well.
Yeah, number one, on the distribution, again, the company has been doing this a long time. So that is challenging, but we have, you know, this approach in place, and it's not easy, but we have a network of you know, other organizations that we call bottlers, but independent companies who we partner with around the world to do what we do. So that it's not easy, but it's something that we do quite well, and perhaps better than anyone when it comes to distribution. But I love the focus on cities, and I actually, again, I'm a strong believer in this approach. So, you know, imagine if city governments, you know, not only companies, but government, you know, education could think about, you know, what are the fixed elements of a program, of a growth strategy, and then what are the flexible elements? And, you know, there's a phrase out there that's often associated with design, less is more. And that's very true when you're scaling something. You know, you reduce something down so you can reduce the friction around it and scale it. But when it comes to being agile and flexible and adaptable, the opposite is true. More is more. So adding more components, just like Legos, you know, they add a lot of components. And the ones that aren't trending anymore, aren't popular anymore, as soon as Harry Potter is not popular anymore, they'll just drop Harry Potter and replace it with whatever. So I think, you know, this approach, this, you know, designing for agility approach can be used by almost any kind of organization. So I'll leave it at that. I could talk about that for an hour. I love that topic, by the way. So.
One question here in the front, and then we'll go to the back after that.
Hi, Michael Pauline, architect, TED speaker, and fellow of the RSA. I'd like to draw you out a bit more on the idea of growth, because I think that's quite a conflicted term, especially when coupled with the word sustainable. And if growth means expanding the total amount of consumption, I think that's problematic. If it means achieving greater domination of the market, I think that's also problematic, because that's often at the expense of a lot of cultural diversity. How do you resolve the conflicts inherent in the idea of growth and sustainable growth?
Okay. For Coca-Cola or just in general related to this?
Yeah, for Coca-Cola.
Okay, Coca-Cola. Yeah, so the reason why I ask is because growth for a startup is in revenue and users. So they're going after, you know, can they actually create revenue? Can they get someone to actually use their product? That's why I was making the distinction. For us, to your point, you know, we can look at growth in terms of value that we're, you know, creating in the marketplace, or volume, or the amount of outlets that we have, or market share. So there's different ways to look at growth. But, you know, I understand your point. Your point is, you know, what's the point? Maybe your point is, when do you reach the point of sustainable growth for the good of the community around the company? Is that what you're getting at?
Well, it's partly that famous quotation which actually appears on the RSA website, I think, with any economist who says exponential growth on a finite planet is possible. It's either a madman or an economist. So, you know, there are real problems with this concept of growth in terms of sustainability.
Yeah, I agree. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be difficult. I'm not understanding the actual question, but I agree with the notion or the fact that, you know, every company must grow sustainably or design sustainably to achieve that growth. I'm missing the specific question. I'm sorry.
Well, a lot of people now are talking about the idea of a steady state economy or a zero growth economy. Personally, I much prefer the idea of a state of dynamic equilibrium, because that's the way that biological systems work. But I really do think that if you're going to talk about growth, you have to address some of those conflicts.
Hi, great talk, by the way. My name is Diana Padilla. I'm a fellow at the RSA, and I work as a strategist in public policy. So I was actually really interested in your model, fixed and flexible. And something that Sever said at the beginning about the concept of being purposeful. Now, when it comes to public policy, a lot of the conversation is about having a purpose for what you do. But you also have political forces that actually disrupt a lot of the fixed elements of the equation. So you constantly are breaking patterns that would actually grow much more efficiently. And I'm just curious on what sort of argument you can actually explore when everybody talks about innovation in public policy, but actually what you do is a lot of disruption that doesn't generate growth, whatever definition growth might be.
Yeah, for me, the way I think about it is in terms of iterative growth, iterative growth or exponential growth. So in my opinion, and what we've demonstrated at Coke, is that on the fixed elements, there's always opportunity for iterative growth. You know, you can always iterate on something to make, a package lighter or something better, you know, something more legible, that kind of thing. But that's always, you know, you create an iterative growth, you know, and, 10% growth. But this sort of 10x kind of growth, I think, has to come through the flexible elements. And those are often by, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So you have to have enough elements there to work with the fixed elements to get to something that can be a whatever game changer. Yeah, again, that's why I love the notion of turning failure around to learning and becoming learning organizations. You know, I think that that's, I'm not just saying this because it's convenient. I actually believe in that, and that's what I do for a living at Coke. So it's constant learning. But again, going to the policy, that only works, from, in my opinion, through being transparent and creating openness across functions or, you know, organizations.
David Lightman, fellow. Having worked with lots of multinationals as well, I'm very interested in your idea that you have to have a transparent process, because the likes of many major multinationals, the transparency of an innovation process leads to a lot of people sticking their oar in and systems grinding to a halt. So how do you overcome that?
Two ways. Great question. I experience that every day, let me say. So one is, first, a story. So when we started this whole process around, again, what's now turned into a seed stage startup portfolio, I used a presentation similar to this for our senior management. And I remember one slide that I used, a PowerPoint slide, that had three words on it. They were learn by doing. And I said, quite honestly at the time, I said, now you'll probably fire me because I don't actually know what you've asked me to do. I don't know how to do what you've asked me to do. But this is the approach we're going to take, learn by doing. And it goes to the failure question. And I just said, we're going to learn our way there. We're going to make lots of mistakes, lots of, you know, things will go wrong. But you'll know about it immediately. So this goes to the openness and transparency thing. So that's how I personally operate at, again, one of the largest companies on the planet. It can be quite challenging, to your point. Everyone has a comment. Everyone has an opinion. But, you know, what I found to be true is just being very open and honest. Whenever anyone wants to see anything, know anything, big failure, you know, huge success, we're quite open with it. So I think that's the only way that it works, in my experience.
Yes, going back to the flexible elements in your report, I mean, I'm interpreting that as a way of hedging your bets against the risk of innovation. You throw enough flexible elements in, half of them are going to fail, half of them will succeed. Have you got a magic figure on how many flexible elements you need in order to guarantee one success?
I'd be a very rich person right now if I were. Yeah. So no, I'm not trying to be sarcastic. No, but that's actually, to your point, again, I say this phrase a lot, but I actually mean it. Oftentimes, you don't know what you don't know. So the challenge is to have enough there to compensate. And, you know, there's no magic number. And it depends on if you're talking about packaging or public policy or, you know, it kind of depends on what the scenario is. But, again, the easiest example is Legos. You can always add more, and there's no risk. You're adding to hedge your bets. You're adding to your possibilities, and that you can always drop them. So those are flexible elements. They can always be dropped. If they're too expensive, or for whatever reason you need to let them go, you let them go. But to answer your question directly, no, I don't. I wish I did, but there's no algorithm around the exact number of flexible elements. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Shaula, and I'm working in a small company, about 50 people. I adore the fact that you managed to, I don't know if it was you, about this fix and flexible, but to rationalize this important fact. And we tried to do it all the time to make it simple. But then once we got it to make it simple, then I think it's human nature. You're trying to make it a little bit more clever. And actually you add complexity. And how do you stop yourself not making it become more complex than what it is now? And it's because it works because it's simple, I suppose.
Yeah, the way I was actually with a large multinational company just last week. I won't name the company, but to actually talk about this. And a similar question was asked there. And the way I would answer that in terms of my own experience in this space is, you know, determining on the fixed side, what are the critical elements that make you, your company, your brand equity, you know, these things that create the culture and maybe, you know, the specific differentiators that make your company, Those are the things that you have to remain sacred. And again, in Coca-Cola's case, Contra Bottle, this Coca-Cola Red, Spencerian Script, you know, these things have never been changed. Every brand manager that joins wants to maybe tweak that, you know, just a little bit, you know, but they never change. And so but those are very few elements. There are very few of those. But, you know, you can only, you know that. Every company or, you know, situation knows that better than anyone. But again, that's why I like, that's the first thing. Second is I like the distinction between fixed and flexible, because to the point, you can have many different flexible elements, and this goes to I forget who asked the question, but the sort of corporate culture. You know, any manager that comes into a corporation, especially a large multinational corporation, wants to have their thumbprint or their influence on the organization, and this system actually allows enormous creativity, allows everyone to sort of add flexible elements. while not destroying the fixed elements that got them there. So anyway, I think this approach is actually, it's been quite successful inside of Coke, and I would imagine it's transferable.
Derek White, and I'm a fellow. Thank you. The companies that you've invested in over the last 18 months, are they all to do with beverage?
No, they're not all to do with beverage. There are two things I'd suggest that they're all focused on. One is we always start with a challenge, a big challenge that we have as a company that's not easily solved inside of our company, right? So if we're working on a new beverage, we know a lot about beverages, so we wouldn't ask them to focus on a milk product or something like that. We know a lot about that already. But there are other challenges that are difficult for us to solve internally. So that's the first thing. The second thing is...
I'll give some examples.
Yeah. Okay, let me just move to an example, and I think it'll clear it up. For example, there is one challenge that we have around the world is what we call out of stocks. It's very easy to understand. You probably know from the name. If we don't have product on the shelf, it's quite annoying for you to go to the shelf and look for your favorite Coca-Cola brand. So Innocent is a brand that is in our portfolio. You go to I was just at the Starbucks down the street. If I were to go in and look for an Innocent, it's not on the shelf. I'm irritated as a consumer or as a shopper, but for the company, it's actually quite a challenge. It's, in fact, a $1 billion challenge for us. When we don't have product on shelf, if you add up all the shelves that we have around the world, that's a lot of lost revenue that we have. So that out-of-stock challenge is a shark bite problem for us. It's a big one. So we actually gave that challenge to one of the startups, in this case in San Francisco. And what they found out, in this case and every other case like this, it's a wicked problem, right? There are lots of interrelated issues, not one solution. What they figured out is that our staffing model wasn't adaptable enough to go after this problem. In other words, we needed an on-demand staffing model, which we don't have. So a guy or a woman comes by 2 times a week or 3 times a week to restock that Innocent. If someone comes in the night before and clears out the shelf, we may have to wait 2 days for that person to come back by. But what if we had an on-demand staffing model where as soon as the shelf was empty, the retailer could post the job, just like Uber, post the job to a site, in this case called Wonolo. If you're a student or someone who wanted to come fill that shelf, you could take the job, come do the job, get paid through the app, just like Uber. In fact, that's the startup. So they launched a startup called Wonolo in the U.S. It's based in San Francisco. Again, to focus on a big challenge that we have, but in fact, many other retailers face the same, many other challenge, consumer goods companies face the same challenge, so they can create a big company based on a big challenge that we have. Does that make sense? Yeah, so that's the case with all the startups. They always start with a big challenge that we have, knowing that they can leverage assets inside of our company to build a big, hopefully a big company around that challenge.
Claudine Blamey, a fellow. I just wondered whether in designing to grow, you've taken into account the concept of a circular economy.
Not specifically in this book. I understand the circular economy, which is related back to here, but not specifically in the book.
Yep, and I saw one question over here.
Hi there. I was reading just the other day that McDonald's declining by 23% or something last year. And I'm curious about, a lot of what you're doing seems to be about kind of incremental innovation and improving the range you have. But at what point in the process would you pick up if you're starting to become not relevant to mainstream trends around health, for example?
Great question. In fact, let me tell you that McDonald's is actually one of our closest customers or partners. And it's been that way for 50 years. And In fact, last week we were on a call with them talking about our startup portfolio and our approach to focusing on challenges and so forth. So that's just to say that every large company is, I think, looking at this. And in fact, I think this approach of large companies opening up their assets to founders, people who want to start businesses around big challenges, I think that's actually a new form of R&D. And it's quite refreshing for me personally, but I think it's quite new for our company, but could be a trend happening once companies figure this out. And that's, to your point, relevancy is exactly what everyone is, I wouldn't say worried about, but must have to continue the brand strength and the sustainability of their company. Yeah.
Could you, it just relates to some of the questions that have been asked. In the book, as an appendix, you have your what's called the Designing with Purpose Manifesto. I wonder if, just sort of in relation to some of the points, if you could tell us a little bit more about that and kind of what exactly that means and how you, in a big company like Coca-Cola, how it's applied.
Yeah, I'm chuckling because how many people have seen the Jerry Maguire movie? It was a long time ago, but I know, but... Okay, so you know how he has this epiphany and he types all night and he runs to Kinko's and makes these copies and distributes them. So I wrote that, and this is before the movie, but it was very much a similar experience. So I had been with the company for just a short amount of time, a few months, and what I realized is that it was a huge company, and in fact, we designed every day, designed new products, new services. The whole company was designing every day, but not everyone understood the impact that they had on the overall success of the company as a designer. And so for me, I wrote that paper. It was a 3-page paper, not a book, and I didn't run anywhere. But, a 3-page paper to just, in my case, try to help senior management understand the effect or the opportunity that design has inside of our company. Because most people, a lot of people think about design as a sort of finishing element, something that's just brought in to, again, make something look nicer or prettier or more fashionable. But in our case, I believe, and the whole focus of the paper was, if we started from the very beginning, it could actually, strategically help our company. But we had to think about it differently. So thus designing on purpose.
Thank you. I wanted to pick up on something you said, and also a lady said about the public sector. What seems to come through is that you really endorse and encourage people permission to fail, which I think is very important because it means people don't get shot for sticking their heads above the parapet and actually trying something. Isn't one of the big differences between the private and the public sector that in the public sector, that is not encouraged, and actually the consequences and or risks as also associated with political cycles means it's really, really difficult to institute. Is there anything that the public sector could learn from the private sector and a way of transporting that to actually encourage faster learning or failing or however you describe it?
Yeah, that's a great topic. Of course, I don't have the answer, but just to think out loud... I think shifting generation towards millennials, often called millennials, I think there are coming more choices or more need for that mindset. Meaning, I have three daughters, the oldest is 13. They could start a company tomorrow. It's actually quite easy to start a company. And this is what large companies are afraid of, right? So, but you no longer have to go through university, be a junior something, and then a manager something, a senior something, and a VP something. You don't have to take that path. You can actually go right around that. And so for me, whether it's public or private, I think that we have to reconcile the fact that there are different options. And with the ubiquity of education and these tools that are available to everyone, you have to actually be more open to that. So again, no answer, of course, but my belief is that things will change. Must change,
Reference your position in the marketplace and your major competitor, Pepsi-Cola. Is there any duality between, how you advance and how possibly they might be?
Of course, we look at all of our competitors, including Pepsi. But I will say that I'm not aware of another company who is taking this approach around truly partnering with founders and co-creating startups. In other words, it's quite popular to start an incubator or accelerator program. Actually, is everyone familiar with an accelerator? Are you familiar with this term? Okay, the way an accelerator usually works, and I know Pepsi tried this a couple years ago. The way an accelerator works is it could be a university, it could be a large company. They set up a program with a specific time frame. So let's say 3 months or 1 month, specific time frame, and almost a formula. So we'll give you as a founder some seed funding, and we'll open up what we call office hours, time where we'll bring in experts to help you do what you want to do. That sounds good, but it's actually not deep enough. It doesn't go into, like in our case, we actually focus on real challenges that we have. We open up all of our assets to help them actually scale and build and scale a business. That approach is actually, we've proven over the last 18 months, has been quite successful for us so far. But it's actually not the typical approach with corporations. So to be very honest with you, I don't know exactly what Pepsi's doing in this space, but I know that what we're doing and it's working for us.
Great, thank you. I think I think we'll just take one more, and then we really must finish there.
Hi, There's a lot of talk about long-termism and 100-year thinking, whole-chain thinking. Is Coca-Cola thinking that far in advance, and is there a successful design formula for the future?
Yeah, again, I'd be a very rich man if I knew the answer to that specifically. No, all I can say is it comes back to this fixed and flexible model. So, again, we're celebrating our 100-year anniversary around that Contra bottle. Hopefully that we can celebrate a 200-year anniversary at some point. But I honestly think this fixed and flexible way of thinking and designing is the way to go, because that hasn't changed over time. I could imagine that would change in the future, but being flexible, being adaptable, will always need to be there. So, yeah.
Great. Thank you very much, everyone, for your question. Just remains to ask David if that's a Coke watch or not.
Happens to be red.
Great. Thank you, everyone, for your questions and for joining us today. So please join me in thanking David.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.